The mystery genre has, for pretty much its entire history, been more of a populist idiom than an art house one. It's often argued that Edgar Allan Poe jump-started the detective story with this famous killer ape tale, and Poe is the textbook example of a mega-famous, widely read author who is routinely dismissed by academics and the literati. I have often wondered why the locked room murder mystery is routinely looked down upon by the cultural elites. Is it because the stories are often formulaic? Is it because they're often driven more by plot than character? Is their very popularity with mass audiences bringing out a contrarian streak in genteel tastemakers? Is it the fact that it's genre fiction? These kinds of folk also tend to not think too highly of horror, science fiction, or superhero yarns either. Regardless, the appeal of the mystery genre is easy to discern. People are intrigued by the ghastly, morbid fascination of murder, hence why also true crime is popular, and people are impressed by the concept of the exceptionally clever detective. People want to play along and see if they can figure out who the killer is before the detective does. So for this recording, we'll be taking a close look at two films based on Murder on the Orient Express, the most famous detective story not written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And boy, does this one have subtext. So let's not waste time anymore and get through the preamble. My name is Ryan. This is a real deep dive. All right, joining me on this one is my sister Sarah.
Hi.
And also Cheryl.
Hello.
I forget who picked this one. It was you, Sarah, right?
It was me.
All right, so what was it about Orient Express that appealed to you?
I had never seen the first version with Sean Connery, and I love Agatha Christie. I think she's better than Doyle myself. And she is one of the things that I found most interesting about her is that she is the best-selling fiction author of all time.
Yeah, I believe only the Bible outdoes it in terms of, like, the accumulated mass of all of Christie's output.
Yeah, she sold over, like, 2 million copies or something like that. It was one of the things that we used to say to try and get the kiddos to check her books out from the library because, you know, the copies that we had were fairly old, so they didn't look exciting. But once we got kids to actually read them, they really liked them. So it was a little bit of a hard sell.
Anyways, Cheryl's also here, and Cheryl, how do you feel about Christie?
I like Agatha Christie just fine. I like Doyle better, but it's okay. I won't hold it against you.
Alright, and before I do the plot, you know what, now let's get the plot recap out of the way. Then I'll go into the historic context. Alright, after reaching Istanbul, Private Detective Hercule Poirot arrives at a hotel where he receives a telegram prompting him to return to London. By the way, I'm going to recap the book's plot. Both of the movies diverge somewhat, but they more or less follow along with this. Poirot instructs the concierge to book him on a first-class compartment on the Orient Express service leaving that night. Although the train is fully booked, Poirot obtains a second-class berth through the intervention of his friend, fellow Belgian, and fellow passenger, Monsieur Bouc, director of the train operator for the CIWL company that runs the Orient Express. Other passengers include American widow Carolyn Hubbard, English governess Mary Debenham, a Swedish missionary Greta Olsen, American businessman Samuel Ratchet, his secretary translator Hector McQueen, and his English valet Edward Henry Masterman. Also, Italian-American car salesman Antonio Foscarelli, Russian princess Natalia Dragomirov, and her German maid Hildegard Schmidt, Hungarian Count Rudolf Andrenyi, and his wife Elena. We also have English Colonel John Arbuthnot, American salesman Cyrus B. Hardman, and Greek medical doctor Stavros Constantine. Ratchet has been receiving death threats. He, recognizing Poirot, he tries to hire him for protection. Poirot, repulsed by Ratchet, refuses, telling him, "I will not take your case because I do not like your face." Bouc has taken the last first-class cabin, but on the first morning he arranges to move into a separate coach and gives Poirot his space. That night, Poirot observes some strange occurrences. Early in the morning, he is awakened by a cry from Ratchet's compartment next door. Pierre Michel, the train's conductor, knocks on Ratchet's door, but a voice from inside responds, "Ce n'est rien, je me suis trompé." It is nothing, I am mistaken. Hubbard rings her bell and tells Michel a man passed through her room. When Poirot rings his bell for water, Michel informs him that the train is stuck in a snowdrift before they could get to Broad, and then he hears a loud thump next door. He observes a woman in a red kimono going towards the washroom, then heading off to sleep. The next morning, with the train still stalled, Bouc informs Poirot that Ratchet has been murdered and that the murderer is still aboard, having no way to escape in the snow. as there are no police on board, Poirot takes up the case. With help from Dr. Constantine, Poirot examines Ratchet's body and compartment, discovering the following. The body has 12 stab wounds, the window has been left open, a handkerchief with the initial H is present in the room, along with a pipe cleaner, a flat match different from the ones that Ratchet used, and a charred piece of paper with "Member Little Daisy Armstrong" written on it. The piece of paper helps Poirot work out the murderer's motive. Many years earlier, American gangster Cassetti kidnapped 3-year-old Daisy Armstrong. Cassetti collected a significant ransom from the wealthy Armstrong family, then revealed that he had already killed the child. Sonia Armstrong, Daisy's mother, who was pregnant with her second child, went into premature labor upon hearing the news and died, along with her baby. Her grieving husband, Colonel Armstrong, shot himself soon after, and Daisy's French nursemaid, Suzanne, was accused of aiding Cassetti and committed suicide, only to be found innocent afterwards. Cassetti escaped justice through corruption and legal technicalities and fled the country. Poirot concludes that Ratchet was actually Cassetti. Whoever had answered the conductor was not Ratchet, as Ratchet did not speak French. As Poirot begins interviewing everyone on the train, he discovers McQueen is directly involved, as he knows about the Armstrong note and believed it was destroyed, and that Hubbard believes that the murderer was in her cabin. While the passengers and Pierre all provide suitable alibis for each other, Poirot notes that some of them observed the woman in the red kimono walking down the hallway on the night of the murder. However, no one admits to owning a red kimono. Hubbard had Olson lock the communicating door between her compartment and that of Cassetti, which invalidates her story of the man in her compartment, and Schmidt bumped into a stranger wearing a Wagenlitz uniform. Miss Debenham inadvertently reveals that she has been to America, contrary to her earlier statements, and Olson shows much emotion when the subject of Daisy is brought up, causing further suspicion. Arbuthnot remarks that Cassetti should have been found guilty in a second trial instead of murdered, and Hardman admits that he is actually a McNeil Agency private detective who was asked to watch out for an assassin that was stalking Cassetti. While inspecting the passenger's luggage, Poirot is surprised to find the label on Countess Andrani's luggage is wet and that her passport is smudged. Schmidt's bag contains the uniform in question, and Poirot's own luggage contains the red kimono recently hidden there. Hubbard herself finds the murder weapon hidden in her sponge bag. Poirot meets with Dr. Constantine and Boog to review the case and develop a list of questions. With these and the evidence in mind, Poirot thinks about the case going into a trance-like state. When he surfaces from it, he deduces the solution. He then calls in the suspects and reveals the true identities of everyone involved and that they are all connected to the Armstrong tragedy in some way, gathering them in the dining car for the second solution. Countess Andrani, née Goldenberg, is Helena, Daisy's aunt, who was a child herself at the time of the tragedy. Rudolph, her loving husband, smudged her luggage label and obscured her name to conceal her identity. Debenham was Helena and Daisy's governess. Foscarelli was the Armstrong chauffeur and a suspect in the kidnapping. Masterman was Colonel Armstrong's valet. Michelle is Suzanne's father and the person who procured the false second uniform. Hubbard is actually the actress Linda Arden, Daisy's grandmother and Sonia and Helena's mother. Schmidt was the Armstrong's cook, and Olson was Daisy's nurse. Princess Dragomirov, in reality Sonia's godmother, claims the monogrammed handkerchief, saying that her forename is Natalia, and the H is actually the Russian letter N. Arbuthnot is there on Debenham's behalf and his own, as he was a personal friend of Colonel Armstrong. Hardman is an ex-policeman who admits that he was in love with Suzanne, and McQueen, who had feelings for Sonia, was the son of the lawyer who represented the Armstrongs. The only passengers not involved in the murder are Book and Dr. Constantine, both having slept in the other coach, which was locked. Poirot then proposes two possible solutions, one far simpler than the other, and advising them to consider both seriously. The first is that a stranger boarded the train when it was stopped, killed Cassetti as a result of a mafia feud, and disembarked at great risk through the snow. The second is that all the clues except the handkerchief and pipe cleaner were planted, and that Michelle and all the passengers in the coach, except Helena, stabbed Cassetti, acting as their own jury. Arden acknowledges everything and offers to take responsibility as she was the mastermind of the scenario. Book and Dr. Constantine, however, decided that the first solution should be relayed to the police instead. Poirot then retires from the case. Alright, for the historic background of this, the Orient Express itself was a long-distance train service created in 1883 by the Belgian company CIWL. Obviously, that is an acronym, but it's in French, so I'm not going to bother. I'm already going to be tripping over too much over the course of this dialogue. The Orient Express traveled from Istanbul to London, with major stations in Paris, Brussels, and Athens, among many others. While initially an ordinary travel route, the Orient Express began imitating the luxurious rail travel motifs of the American Pullman cars. In Agatha Christie's time, only ludicrously wealthy people could afford to travel on the Orient Express. Interestingly enough, out of everyone who's appeared in either movie, the only one I could confirm who traveled the Orient Express themselves was Josh Gad.
That's delightful. I like that.
The service ran in some shape or form until 2009, although a number of transport companies currently use the name all over the world. In fiction, the Orient Express figures prominently in Bram Stoker's Dracula and Graham Greene's Stamboul Train, which was retitled the Orient Express upon its American release. The 1934 film, Orient Express, adapted from the Greene novel, debuted the same year that Christie's novel came out. The other significant Orient Express thriller is Ian Fleming's From Russia with Love, whose climax involves James Bond battling Soviet agents on the train. This came about during a period where the Iron Curtain nations were severing ties with CIWL and creating their own rail lines. The other major historical touchstone referenced in Murder on the Orient Express is the Lindbergh kidnapping. In 1932, the child of famous aviator Charles Lindbergh was abducted from their crib. While a ransom was proposed and paid, the baby's corpse was discovered in a nearby road several months later. In 1934, German-born carpenter Bruno Hauptmann was arrested, tried, and convicted for the crime. While he maintained his innocence, and there are people speculating about it to this present day, Hauptmann was executed via electric chair in 1936. The Lindbergh kidnapping was a media sensation, and Hauptmann's trial was one of the first dubbed the Trial of the Century. The Federal Kidnapping Act, which made it a federal crime to transport kidnapping victims across state lines, was drafted and passed as a direct result of the Lindbergh abduction. So, Murder on the Orient Express is one of those rip-from-the-headlines mysteries comparable to all those Law & Order episodes that comment on contemporary true crime cases. People who bought the book in 1934 couldn't help but notice the parallels. As for the source novel, Christie claimed that she dreamt up the plot of the novel while traveling on the Orient Express and getting delayed due to a severe rainfall washing out the tracks. This made her think of an incident a few years prior where the Orient Express was delayed for 6 days because of a snowdrift collapsing on it. Christie's hero for the story was Hercule Poirot, the eccentric Belgian detective she debuted in 1920's The Mysterious Affair at Styles. Poirot was Christie's most popular character by far, which irritated Christie somewhat. In 1960, she claimed in an interview to despise the character, calling him a detestable, bombastic, tiresome, egocentric little creep.
She's not wrong.
I mean, I'm a Marple partisan myself.
Yeah.
Unlike Arthur Conan Doyle, however, Christie considered herself to be an entertainer more than an artist, and considering it her duty to produce what her audience wanted, churned out 33 novels, 2 plays, and 51 short stories featuring Poirot before killing him off in 1975's Curtain. The novel, Murder on the Orient Express, was published in 1934 after being serialized in the Saturday Evening Post. It appeared under the title of Murder on the Calais Coach in the United States in order to avoid confusion with the Greene novel. And that's where it lay for a while, aside from, like, you know, radio dramas and whatnot. Aside from Billy Wilder's 1957 film Witness for the Prosecution, Christie strongly disliked pretty much every film adaptation of her work, and by the 1970s was reluctant to sell movie rights to anyone. What changed things was producer John Braborn. His father-in-law was of the British royal family and had access to Christie. He managed to talk her into it after Christie watched and approved of Braborn projects like 1968's version of Romeo and Juliet and the 1971 ballet version of Tales of Beatrix Potter. Director Sidney Lumet, after he was attached to the project, felt that the large number of characters, backstories, and plot twists would only be accessible to audiences if there was a star-studded cast of familiar faces. Having worked with Sean Connery several times before, he approached Connery first with the assumption that lots of other celebrities would sign on as soon as Connery did. Connery was flattered by this assertion, but he insists that it was Albert Finney's casting as Poirot be the thing that sealed the deal. Every other actor signed on within a few weeks of Finney agreeing to play the character. Lauren Bacall specifically flat out admitted that she only signed on because she wanted to work with Finney. Finney, however, was not the first choice. Sidney Lumet approached Alec Guinness and asked him, but Guinness was busy.
Yeah, I imagine he was busy, but that would be such a different movie.
Guinness would have killed it as Poirot, I think.
Oh, 100%. But yeah.
One complication with Finney playing Poirot, however, is that he was 37 when they started shooting the movie. And in order to make him look like he was in his late 40s, early 50s, he needed extensive makeup. Another complication, however, is that Finney was acting in a stage play at the very same time that shooting was happening, and he didn't have much time. So in order to get him some sleep, the studio set up a system where he would go to bed in his hotel room on an ambulance stretcher. And then every morning, a rented ambulance would pull up to the hotel, and attendants would wheel him out onto the ambulance while he was still asleep.
This sounds like my nightmare.
They'd give him makeup while he was still napping on the way to the set.
That is I cannot imagine falling asleep in your bed and then waking up on a gurney
while people are putting makeup on you.
And theoretically changing you into a different outfit as well, yes?
I guess.
That's horrifying.
Well, he sucked it up and put on his big boy pants and went through with it.
All I can think of is hedonism bot, though. Like, that's all I'm making sure of.
That's the thing. John Gielgud and Vanessa Redgrave are also performing in stage plays at that point, but I guess their characters are smaller, so they didn't have to go through such great lengths.
Well, I mean, they're not Poirot.
Yeah. Lumet also approached Ingrid Bergman with an offer to play any character that she wanted, although he tried to push her towards playing the Princess Dragomiroff. Bergman, however, insisted that she was best suited to play Greta Olsen, and despite it being a much smaller part, she's like, no, this character is the right one for me. Greta only gets one major speaking part in the 1974 film, so Lumet shot the scene in one unbroken take. He was blown away by Bergman's range in the scene and credits it with her Oscar win. In her acceptance speech, Bergman apologized to Valentina Cortesi, expressing that she believed Cortesi should have won for her performance in Day for Night. John Gielgud might have agreed. When asked about working with Bergman, he quipped, "Ingrid Bergman can speak 5 languages and she can't act in any of them."
No!
That is awful.
What a bitch!
Yeah, he's a bit of a bitch. It's delightful.
He's a little bitch!
Lumet suggested Marlene Dietrich to play the Princess Dragomiroff, but producers felt that this would be a distractingly campy choice. Wendy Hiller, who was in her early 60s at the time and therefore needed extensive makeup to appear elderly, signed on more or less at the last minute. There was an issue with the 1974 shoot in that it was unseasonably warm and there was no snow. They started trucking in snow to dump onto the set, but the trucks were delayed by a blizzard that broke out. Old train carts from the Orient Express were borrowed from railway museums, and the crew even got a period train engine. This did, however, make it tough to get all the camera equipment in the right place. Finney's climactic monologue took ages to shoot, and the cast members got really sick of sitting perfectly still in between takes, sometimes for hours on end, in order to preserve continuity. They toughed it out, however, largely because they admired Finney and they wanted to support his big moment. To keep costs down, the studio pushed for a 30-minute lunch rather than an hour-long lunch. Vanessa Redgrave, a passionate communist, fought hard against this measure, seeing it as a slippery slope to further erode the workers' rights.
Gee, I wonder how other people in Hollywood feel about that now.
Redgrave also added that since these were name actors they were dealing with, if they put their foot down, then that would stop it right at the source. Whereas, the smaller crew members who weren't celebrities, they would just have to take it on the chin. So they had a responsibility to fight this. However,
they didn't, did they?
Yeah, Redgrave was outvoted by the rest of the cast and crew, and she spent most of the meal breaks or the remainder of the shoot ranting to anyone who will listen about the importance of worker solidarity. Most people, towards the end of the shoot, preferred lunching with Gielgud, who mostly just told funny, bitchy showbiz anecdotes the whole time.
I mean, that just sounds like a great time.
It does sound better than somebody on their soapbox yelling at you.
The music for the film was composed by Richard Rodney Bennett. He was asked by Lumet to avoid brooding atmospheric musical cues that were common to mystery films, and he said that he wanted him to treat the train like it was the main character. So what we get is a rousing, nostalgic, and energetic score, particularly a long, extended suite as the train is just like pulling out and going on. You're just getting atmospheric establishing shots for almost 20 minutes. Bennett himself is the score's piano soloist. It was recorded by the Orchestra of the Royal Opera House with Marcus Dodd holding the conductor's baton. At the film's premiere, Bennett was stopped by an irate Bernard Herrmann, who criticized him for using major chords and abandoning any idea of tension throughout the score, which is a very Bernard Herrmann thing to say.
I don't know who that is, but he sounds like a jerk.
Bernard Herrmann is one of the most famous movie composers of all time. He's best known for Psycho and Vertigo. His first score was Citizen Kane, his last was Taxi Driver.
Okay, so, I mean, he has a motif.
Yeah, the guy who wrote Psycho thinks that the Orient Express score didn't have enough tension.
Yeah, of course he doesn't want you to use major chords. He did, did he do, like, a lot of Hitchcock films?
Yeah, he did almost all of the famous ones.
Yeah, so, yeah, of course he didn't want you to use major chords.
Bennett shrugged this criticism off as the music was widely embraced elsewhere. In fact, if you go to, like, pops orchestras to this day, they will often do an Orient Express suite. It's kind of entered the canon of great film music.
Well then, ha ha, ha.
A few of Bernard Herrmann's scores are also in that canon.
Yeah, but you know why? He's got company, so he can just suck it up.
Christie attended the premiere, which was her last public appearance before she died. She praised the film, although she quibbled about Finney's mustache not being big enough.
Yes!
I mean, yeah.
The mustache is the best part of the character.
I would argue that the mustache is the main character. It's commented on quite a bit.
Murder on the Orient Express was a big financial hit. It grossed $35.7 million off a $1.4 million budget. Reviewers were overwhelmingly positive. It has like a 90% on Rotten Tomatoes. It got Oscar nominations for Best Actor for Finney, Best Supporting Actress for Bergman, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Cinematography, Best Costume Design, and Best Score. It lost every category except for Supporting Actress. 1974 was a crazy competitive year for Hollywood cinema. This is the year that Godfather 2, Chinatown, Towering Inferno, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, The Conversation, and the aforementioned Day for Night got lots of Oscar attention. Also, The Great Gatsby came out that year, and while most people believe that the 1970s Great Gatsby is dog shit, the costumes are pretty and it won for that.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, it's not good.
Nah.
All right, and that brings us to the 2017 film.
Yay, Pretty Mustache!
And what a mustache it is.
After acquiring the film rights, 20th Century Fox brought Kenneth Branagh on to direct and eventually star as Poirot in the Orient Express film, with the hopes of spawning a franchise. Death on the Nile is very pointedly teased at the end of this movie. Branagh, a veteran of both stage and screen, assembled the cast with his Rolodex, essentially. Every actor in the film was a personal friend, a former co-star, or a former member of Branagh's acting troupe. Angelina Jolie entered talks to play Mrs. Hubbard, but ducked out when the studio refused to rewrite the character to suit her screen persona. Charlize Theron was also considered until Michelle Pfeiffer's agent got interested.
Yes, Pfeiffer!
Although, Theron would have been awesome, too. She's so good.
I'm pleased with Michelle Pfeiffer.
I mean, who isn't?
A problematic member of the cast was Johnny Depp.
You don't
Surprise!
Say!
Surprise and shock and awe.
He showed up on his first day late, hours late, hungover, and unable to remember his lines. Branagh brought him out in front of everyone and gave a very paternal dressing down of him, expressing disappointment in him and telling him that he should quit if he won't be a damn professional.
Ooh, what happened next?
Depp, thoroughly embarrassed, showed up on time and sober for the remainder of the shoot.
Good.
Josh Gad would pepper Daisy Ridley with Star Wars questions and then upload her comedically irritated responses to social media.
Also good.
I would like to track those down.
Most of the Orient Express cast and J.J. Abrams participated in at some point. I believe they're still on Josh Gad's Instagram. Filming took place over 7 months. It used experimental 65mm cameras that Branagh admired while he was performing a Christopher Nolan's war movie Dunkirk. Towards the end of the shoot, Pfeiffer Skyped Branagh with a song that she was working on called Never Forget. It is used in the end credits of the movie. The score for this film is by Patrick Doyle, who is one of Branagh's regulars. I think it's much more traditional than the one in the 1974 film, and it uses a lot of those spooky motifs that you generally associate with mystery films.
Which I don't mind, by the way. I think it's fun.
I really love the tinkling noise, like, song at the end. I don't know what you call that. Like, when they're towards the end of the movie.
Both versions of Orient Express have very splashy cinematography. Sidney Lumet is one of my all-time favorite directors, and, like, this is a B-tier film for him. Like, the 1970s are very good for Sidney Lumet, but even then, the camera's always moving. It is very good at establishing scenes. I think it has a better sense of mise-en-scene than the 2017 film. Like, there are all these extras who are puttering about and going about their lives, and the world feels very lived in. Whereas a lot of people compare the 2017 Orient Express to a superhero movie, and it kind of is. It's like very clearly working on franchise maintenance, even though it's still the first installment. And the cameras there are also moving, but also assuming that the audience is going to get bored too easily. The 2017 movie seems to take any excuse it can to get everybody off the train. Like, there's a superfluous scene where Poirot is just like standing on the roof of the train, and Branagh mentioned that like he had to wear a harness for it, but it still scared him. And instead of like in the cabin for the locked room reveal, he brings them to the tunnel. There's a shootout scene that's just sort of inserted in there for some reason. There's more action, action, action.
But I also really like that the beginning of the movie kind of just, you get like more insight into where he's leaving from than the 70s movie. Like, I like the cute little like puzzle at the beginning and how like, you know, they treat it like a location that's like culturally significant, whereas the other one is like, oh, look at this exotic train station.
Yeah, that is a strong difference I found between the 1974 one and the 2017 one, is that race and ethnicity is pointed out more thoroughly in the 2017 film. Like, the Branagh Poirot only signs on to the case when Book implies that, you know, if the ordinary police get involved, they'll probably just grab somebody who's ethnic and convict them and hang them because they need somebody, and, you know, a black guy's good enough.
Yeah. I'm gonna sound like a complete idiot for a second, and please edit this out if need be, but Sidney Lumet, was he one of the ones who Judy Garland married?
No.
Which Sidney is that?
Sylvan is screaming somewhere right now.
Yeah, Sidney Lumet directed 12 Angry Men, Failsafe, Dog Day Afternoon, The Verdict, Network. Okay. You never worked with Judy Garland, as far as I know. And anyways, the 2017 version of Murder on the Orient Express got good-ish reviews. It has a 60% on Rotten Tomatoes. Most people praised the film for being stylish and having nifty costumes, and they generally said nice things about the ensemble cast, although overall the film was compared very unfavorably to the 1974 film.
I always disagree with Rotten Tomatoes, apparently. I prefer the 2017 one.
Me too.
It had a budget of $55 million and grossed $352.8.
I mean, think about the Book. The Book in the 2017 one is delightful.
He is. The cast is fantastic, and this is one of those movies, stories, whatever, where the cast of individual characters really makes the film. Not to knock Sean Connery or anything, but, like, Michelle Pfeiffer.
You also like the Poirot of this one. You sympathize with him. Like, I want to see him solve crimes.
Yeah, there's more aggressive humanizing for Poirot. We get moments where he's sitting there and he's having doubts about the case. There's him reminiscing about his lost love. At the beginning of the film, he's very much saying, like, there is black, there is white, there is right, there is wrong. And towards the end of the film, he's like, oh no, the world is more complicated than I wanted it to be.
Mm.
That's his character arc for this.
Well, and also you've got, you know, Dame Judi Dench.
They're also cranking up Poirot's autism.
Fair.
This is during this period where it was still okay to imply that, like, genius detectives got superpowers from their autism.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there have been two sequels to the 2017 film so far. Death on the Nile was started almost immediately after the 2017 film, but was delayed to 2022 due to Disney buying Fox, the COVID-19 pandemic, and one of the main characters being a rapist in real life. Haunting in Venice followed in 2023. Alright, so let's do some compare and contrast for the cast now. We have Albert Finney and Kenneth Branagh as Poirot.
I mean, one of them's sympathetic and I just want to hug him.
And one has a much better mustache.
And I do think that Kenneth Branagh is one of modern cinema's greatest hams, particularly in his Shakespeare movies. He doesn't get to chew quite as much scenery in this one, but he gets a lot of moments. I do think that Finney is very good as the Agatha Christie Poirot, as the, you know, the smug, self-satisfied, eccentric detective type.
Yeah, you know, the one who's kind of a dick and she hated.
All right, then we have Lauren Bacall and Michelle Pfeiffer as Mrs. Hubbard.
Michelle Pfeiffer, hands down.
I was going to say, I think you already know who we picked.
I mean, I think it's a dead heat. I love Lauren Bacall, and I think she did a great job in the 74 movie.
I don't disagree. It's just, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer.
When Michelle Pfeiffer cry yells and tries to shoot herself, I'm like, oh my God, Hubbard.
Heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. I think Pfeiffer does a better Arden. Like, she gives a better Arden.
Yeah, overall, the 2017 film just leans more heavily into the melodrama, so if that's what you're looking for, the 2017 film is where it's at.
And it's always what I'm looking for.
Well, and it was what Agatha Christie was catering to. She, as you said earlier, she was an entertainer. She gave the audiences what they wanted, and yeah, people want melodrama.
Drama!
I mean, if you read the book is set up more like a Swiss clock. It's very plot-centric, it's very attuned to, okay, this is the first act, this is the second act, this is the third act. And something that neither adaptation handles is that in the book, the main complication is that everyone there is of different ethnicities and different national backgrounds, and there's lots of confusion and misunderstanding in the language, which doesn't translate to cinema super great.
Yeah. I did like the scene where he had her speaking in German so that the princess wouldn't understand. I thought that was well done.
Oh my gosh, and him looking for the word for fudge, that was very cute.
Delightful. The English, chocolate. Fudge? Yes, it's all fudge.
Then we have Ingrid Bergman as Greta, and then Penelope Cruz as Pilar. They changed the character's name because of the ethnic difference. I thought it was very pointedly different is that, as I mentioned already, Greta's interrogation is one single unbroken take so Bergman can show off, because that's the only scene that she gets. Whereas when Cruz starts talking, we immediately cut to him interrogating somebody else, and it's like, oh, come on, Cruz is good.
And she is. She should have. I feel like she was the one who got, like, the least amount of screen time.
And yeah, I do think that there are lots of histories in the Academy Awards where, like, the famous big-name actress or actor gets a statue as an apology, even if it's a small role. And yeah, that's definitely Bergman. Like, they gave her the statue for this one because she's good in that one scene in Murder on the Orient Express, but it's because they hadn't honored her properly beforehand. I mean, most people think of Ingrid Bergman as from Casablanca. Anyways, moving on, we have Wendy Hiller and Judi Dench as the Princess Dragomiroff.
I will always choose Judi Dench. Judi Dench is never the wrong answer.
Judi Dench was obvious stunt casting here. This is a character she could sleepwalk through. Wendy Hiller, on the other hand, I think she did a very nice job, but she was the third choice.
The lip smacking that she does is always super distracting to me in the 70s one.
Oh, when Judi Dench spits. Poirot's face after she does it. Delightful.
No, she was spitting down. It's a cultural thing.
I know.
It wasn't in his face.
No, it wasn't in his face, but I said his face after.
Oh.
Yeah. Because she's spitting towards Cassetti.
On his name.
Yes.
It's on his memory and his name.
Indeed.
All right, then we have Anthony Perkins and Josh Gad as Hector McQueen.
So Josh Gad. Just
pick the gayest guy at the moment to play Hector McQueen.
Yep.
When we were watching the 74 one, he's like, so Anthony Perkins just plays a guy with a weird mother fixation in everything he's in? And I was like, not quite, but yes, in this one.
Yeah,
Also, why didn't we get Gad in the kimono, right? Why'd they give that to someone else?
Gad will do pretty much whatever you ask him to. He's a great sport, so...
Yeah, and they clearly asked him to tone down the gay for this.
They're like, we want you to be really drunk instead. Like, yeah. The whole time, just drunk.
Just drunk and bitter. Then we have Jacqueline Bisset and Lucy Boynton as the Countess Helena Andreini. Small character in both versions, I think. I think the 2017 one, Boynton distinguished herself a little bit more. You know, she's strung out on the barbiturates.
She does a very, very good job at that.
Playing off of her, the actor who plays her husband, too. Oh my gosh, that man's face every time is terrifying to me.
He's so pretty, though.
I know, but they both look.
No.
He does look like he's going to, like, high kick your head off. I love that all of his attacks are high kicks.
All right, then Daisy Ridley and Vanessa Redgrave as Mary Debenham.
I adore Daisy Ridley.
Two very different thespians playing that same character.
Yeah.
It feels like kind of apples and oranges to put them against each other.
Agreed.
And I think Ridley is given a bit more to do than Redgrave was. You know, she gets that whole solo scene where she's sitting in the train compartment and Poirot accuses her directly, and then that starts the dramatic gunfight. Alright, then Richard Widmark and Johnny Depp as Ratchet. Fairly small character for both because, you know, he's dead by the end of Act 1.
I will say that I was actually impressed by Johnny Depp in this movie.
Oh, Depp's a good actor, and he's good at playing an oily scumbag. I was gonna say, yeah, he's
a very convincing scumbag.
And that accent, like, he has that face and that accent, like that stink face and that accent the whole time he's alive.
Yeah, I believe Brana when he's just repulsed by sitting across the table from that guy. And Widmark is, I mean, he came right out of Central Casting. I haven't looked him up on IMDb or anything, but I had an easy time believing he played gangsters in most everything he was in, probably. Alright, this one's a little more complicated. Sean Connery and Leslie Odom Jr. playing Dr. Arbuthnot or Colonel Arbuthnot, depending on it. Odom's character is sort of a composite between the Colonel and Dr. Constantine, who is not in the 2017 one. They mushed two characters together to give you one less person to think about.
So I really like Leslie Odom Jr. You know, my first introduction to him, as most people's, was Hamilton. But, you know, I think he's a fairly good actor and he deserves more credit than he gets. It does feel a little forced for him to be both the army soldier and the doctor.
I didn't have a problem with that. I just thought it was a pretty boring role. Like, he doesn't get good lines.
He really doesn't get much to do.
You're gonna get a shootout scene, but immediately get hit with a sack of flour.
Yeah, I consider it another apples and oranges things. Like, Connery might as well be a different person. I mean, he is a different person, but you get what I mean.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, Michael York and then Sergei Polonin as Count Rudolf Andreni.
Oh my gosh, the 2017 one. Hands down, that face. That high kick.
Yeah, I don't find Michael York's high kick nearly as intimidating.
No.
Which is why he did not do one.
Every time I see the reporters, I get startled and delighted every time. Just that guy that just breaks his own camera. I'm like, I would too.
Speaking of characters who are radically changed because the actor is of a different ethnicity, Dennis Quilly and then Manuel Garcia Rufo as, depending on the film, Antonio Foscarelli or Bienvenido Marquez. Both of them are used car salesmen who are former chauffeurs, but both of them act very differently.
Again, that's a smaller role that you really don't get much out of.
No, I like the 2017 one. He's more charming and he sticks in my brain.
Fair.
I mean, everyone in the 2017 film is just more attractive physically.
I would agree to that, yeah.
Marquez is a charmer, whereas Foscarelli, he seems like an awkward dork, but he's hiding something. I think, depending on what you're going for, one is better than the other. Then we have that bitch, John Gielgud, and then Derek Jacobi as Edward Beddoes or Masterman, depending on the film. Either way, he's the butler.
I mean, if you want to scale them on, like, who was the bitchier character, then we're going with the 2017 one.
I don't know.
Say.
I kind of like a zinger in the 1974 one, where it's like, usually when members of the service are asked for references, it is perhaps more appropriate that it goes the other way around, or something along those lines.
Ooh.
Yeah, he is pretty catty, and I just enjoy it. In both ones, I don't think it really... They're pretty a good dead heat.
Then we have Martin Balsam and Tom Bateman as Bianchi, who's Italian in the 1974 film, or Book.
Book!
Book.
Are you kidding me? He's just so delightful.
And he loves Poirot. He adores Poirot.
He's like, what did he say? Like, I mastered the art of nepotism? Yeah. I was like, yes. Yes, 1,000 times yes.
Delightful human.
It is easier to be okay with Nepo babies when they admit to it. Like, Kurt Russell's like, yeah, of course. My parents were actors. That's why I'm one. All right, and then last person I wrote down was Colin Blakely and Willem Dafoe as Cyrus Gerald Hardman.
I will always love Willem Dafoe. It doesn't matter what role he has. He's one of those actors.
His immediate transition from accent to accent is... And just the, how did you know? And he's like, darn it. Like, he's so excited that Poirot has figured him out. Are we not going to talk about Olivia?
I suppose if you want to.
I love her. I love her so much. Do you not?
I don't know, I guess I wrote down everybody in a rush, and I was like, is that everyone? I think that's everyone.
I don't remember who played that character in the 70s one, but, I mean, I watch pretty much everything with Olivia Colman in it, so.
Alright, and with that out of the way, let's move on to themes. The first thing I wrote down was socially acceptable killing.
Well, as long long as it's lighthearted, Ryan.
A parable, which I've heard is Buddhist, but I'm not certain about that, regards stumbling upon a man attacking someone, and it becomes clear that the only way to save the victim is to mortally wound the attacker. So what to do? To many religious and philosophical perspectives, the situation is impossible to resolve, or at the very least is a Scylla and Charybdis scenario. It's argued that all life is sacred, and the violent destruction of anyone is a loss to us all. It's also said in the scenario that violence just begets more violence. The attacker likely has friends and family who feel obligated to avenge him. Killing the attacker would also add further precedent to the notion that violence is a quick, efficient, and effective way to solve problems, including problems that are less perfectly clear-cut and black and white than this particular hypothetical. In the case of this, I find that second argument to be the most compelling. I mean, for most of my personal problems, punching someone in the face might make me feel good for a moment or two, but then would make things infinitely worse for me. Also, I'm an American living in 2023. Just about everything bad that's happened in regards to a foreign country is the direct result of American imperialism destabilizing the region and then sowing negative discord that ended up blowing up back towards us a decade or so later. So I am sympathetic to this theory. On the other hand, I have personally never lost a loved one due to violent murder. Whenever the subject comes up, I always think of a documentary I watched about Jeffrey Dahmer, and the parent of one of his victims flat out said, "I forgive Jeffrey Dahmer because he was insane." And that really struck me because I don't think I have it in me to do that.
When our nephew was very small, he was probably like 3 or 4, I saw another toddler push him off the slide, and I actively was filled with rage and walked over to that child's parents and started yelling at the parents because I wouldn't yell at a kid. So I definitely don't think I'm capable of forgiving somebody for hurting someone I love.
I have struggled with it. I am in the unique position of, well, it's not so unique, but I think it's unique in this room, of having lost multiple friends to the opioid crisis. And while I can, you know, point fingers and name names as to, you know, who supplied them with it and who got them back into it once they were clean, they are also sick and suffering, and so I kind of had to let that go because otherwise I wouldn't be able to move on from it. Doesn't make it any better.
Just in an abstract sense, I am enraged at pharmaceutical companies that
promoted
OxyContin and therefore ginned up the opioid crisis of the 2010s.
Yes, yes.
It pisses me off that they got away with it. And if someone stabbed them to death, I wouldn't say hooray, but I wouldn't lose any sleep either.
Yes. So them, yes. But other people that were also affected by the opioid crisis and happened to, you know, wrangle my friends back into it, not so much. Even though they had a direct responsibility for it, you know?
Yeah, and that's the thing about parables, is that they're open-ended. They're not supposed to tell you what the solution is. That's one of the many, many reasons why the Bible is as frustrating as it is. So, yeah, if you came listening to this podcast to get a clear-cut answer on whether or not there's ever a situation for murder is justifiable, none of us have a straight answer for you, sorry.
Except for, don't push my nephew off the slide.
Yeah, don't do that. But yeah, that brings me to my second theme, which is class. I would say Murder on the Orient Express is perhaps accidentally about social caste. One could argue that the aristocrats who kill Rackman are morally justified, although I consider that to be a pretty complex issue. Still, Christie lets them off the hook in the book, and most of the outside media adaptations generally depict these characters sympathetically, especially the 2017 film. As Cheryl and Sarah pointed out, that bit where Michelle Pfeiffer grabs the gun and almost shoots herself in the head, only to realize that the gun isn't loaded. Yeah, you're not supposed to be like, yeah, do it. The film is very clearly framing this as a tragic circumstance, and that these are wounded, broken people who should be given a chance to rebuild their lives and become better again.
Yeah, Poirot's whole speech about, you know, a murder should only affect the one person, but it doesn't, it affects, you know, how many people it has damaged, and he points to all of them, and it's like, you know, how many lives.
Well, and, like, they really build, like, the companionship and the camaraderie between all of the murderers, too. like, so-and-so hired so-and-so, so-and-so promoted so-and-so, so-and-so paid for this person to go to school. Like, it's very much a lot of people reaching around and connecting.
Yeah, and you don't feel like it's a stretch that they're all connected to this case, because every single one of them makes sense.
It's like a loving network, which is, it's interesting, because, yeah, you don't really get that in a lot of stories.
In a weird way, sort of reminded me of raising my kiddo. They say it takes a village, and the Armstrongs clearly had a village helping them take care of their kiddo. So it was like, oh yeah, like you were saying, don't push my nephew down a slide. Like, there are many people who helped me take care of him as he was growing up who would be absolutely devastated and furious to find that somebody had hurt him.
Yeah, the Armstrongs in this case were celebrity millionaires, and their real-life counterparts were also celebrity millionaires and Nazi sympathizers.
Yeah,
Charles Lindbergh was the leader of the America First movement. But anyways,
I forgot about that. They talk a lot about communism in this one, too. They talk about Stalin a lot.
Oh, yeah, he was ascending to power, but, you know, so was Mussolini and Hitler. But, yeah, the only reason that all of these people are able to wriggle out of legal consequences are because of their massive privilege. Even if the rail line didn't want to avoid negative publicity and push Poirot into sweeping the matter under the rug, it's tough to envision a plausible scenario where anyone goes to prison here. High-priced lawyers can drag things out for years, and if worse comes to worse, they can abscond to a place that doesn't extradite, just like Rackman did. The justice system was, after all, set up by people who are not bound to it, but are protected by it. And I think that's as true in 1934 as it was in 1834, or now.
Yeah.
Lots of people would have justifiable reasons, if you argue it a certain way, to stab someone to death. But only a Russian princess will be able to get away with it. Anyways, that's everything in my notes. Is there anything that either of you would like to say about either Orient Express before we sign off?
We haven't talked about his mustache caddy.
Oh, the net.
Mm-hmm.
That went over his mustache.
I mean, he wears the net in both films.
But it's so much bigger and better in the 2017 film.
I found myself looking at Kenneth Branagh's mustache quite a lot. It's got like the two swoops, right? It's got like one swoop up and then it's got another one underneath it, and it just makes it look like feathers.
And it's so full. And like it's nicely waxed. Like I very much enjoy it.
Good prosthetics there, like good makeup, whatever, because that's clearly not a real mustache, but I love it.
So you think Christy would have approved?
I do.
All right, well, thanks for listening, everybody, and join us next time.
Maybe we won't be as much of a downer?
I doubt it.
No promises.
I think the only time we didn't have, like, a downer episode was when we spent, like, an hour talking about butts after watching that animated movie.
Yeah, stop picking murder mysteries. We're supposed to do Spice World. Maybe do Spice World.
We have to get a copy of it.
Oh, I have one.
Oh, then why haven't we done Spice World?
You haven't picked it.
I picked it months ago.